Hey Fresh Capital listeners, as we reach the end of the year, in this episode we're recapping or wrapping the 2022 season of Fresh Capital by looking at Albert and my top three companies for 2022. This doesn't mean the best or biggest companies that we've covered, but it's more of a personal dive into the top three companies for both of us that resonated and continue to live rent-free in our heads. Keep listening and enjoy. Welcome to another episode of Fresh Capital. Every week we provide a refreshingly simple way to learn about companies and investing. My name is Dan. Joining me, as always, coming into Sydney late last night, Albert, how are you doing?
Dan, I'm good. You know, I spent a couple, maybe 2 weeks overseas. It's good to be home and drink tap water and, you know, bought a good coffee the first time this morning, so I'm feeling good. How are you?
I'm doing well. I arrived home late last night as well into Canberra. My lease ended, so I packed up everything in a car and drove all the way back down to Canberra. Eventful. I didn't realize, but the 24-hour McDonald's does actually shut down between sort of 1 and 2, and I unfortunately got caught up in that, that brief window of time where they weren't available.
Oh, no. What a lie.
But McDonald's isn't on my list of companies we're going to be talking about today, Al, but maybe one day we'll talk about McDonald's. Today, I guess the theme or the premise of the episode, particularly as we kind of wrap up 2022, is to look at the 50-odd or so companies that we've deep-dived into this year and pick out, you know, three each, and they may overlap, but three companies each which we found interesting for some sort of reason that resonated with us and that we wanted to kind of recap and just discuss again a little bit further in this week's episode. Albert, anything else to add to that intro?
No, I think that's a good overview of what we're going to talk about today. I think the other thing worth calling out is like a few weeks ago, we did an episode draft where we drafted companies that we really enjoyed talking about and companies we thought were going to be, you know, for lack of a better word, generational. And it's definitely worth listening to that because I think we're going to try avoid overlap between that episode and this episode. So if you want to understand which companies we really love, definitely one episode to check out.
Definitely. And I think this is a good one for your sort of Christmas listening list. You know, I'll shout out at the very least the episode numbers for these companies that we're talking about. So if you wanted to, you know, hear a little bit more about these episodes that we're obviously going to overview in this one, but you want to get the deeper dive, deeper context if you haven't listened already, or if you want to listen to again and remind yourself, then just queue it up over Christmas, you know, have your Christmas lunch and then settle in for some fresh cap. Without any further ado, Albert, I might throw it over to you. Do you want to give us your first, you know, one of your top three companies of the year that we've covered?
Yeah, so to frame it up, I thought about this in a kind of structured way. I had lots of different ways to think about this, but I settled on and this framework, which is a company I still think a lot about, a company that I ended up investing in. And, you know, this is entertainment only, not financial advice, do your own research, and then a company that I learned a lot about after we talked about on the pod. So to hit from the top, the company I think about a lot, FONA, or Formula One Group. So the ownership company who owns Formula One. It's actually one of the tracking stocks of Liberty Media. So definitely go check it out. Check out the episode we did on FONA or Liberty Media. But, you know, a quick, you know, overview. Formula One, it's a sport, you know, high octane, high power sport that consists of 12 races, Grand Prix, where drivers compete to race in each of these races. And the winner at the end becomes obviously the champion. So definitely check out that episode. But, you know, the reason why I still think about this a lot is because something that FONA, Formula One Group, has done that we're seeing a lot now in the streaming and media space is taking a sport and then building a content universe around the sport. And they were one of the first to do it and do it in a way that is really, really exciting and engaging for non-fans in a way to draw people into the sport. Like Formula One was not a popular sport. It was a very like kind of dwindling sport with a fan base that was shrinking. Netflix came in and did their Drive to Survive, which kind of blew up the sport, and now it's really popular with young people. You know, it's high octane, it's really exciting. But I think outside of just the Netflix special, Drive to Survive, something they've done really well is really just monetize streaming around the sport and streaming content around the sport. And the reason I think about this a lot is because a lot of sport have moved in, or sporting leagues, sporting events have moved in that direction. A good example I'll call out now is tennis, where they've got their own streaming service. But now they've recently partnered with Netflix to launch their own Netflix special that's kind of very similar to Drive to Survive, but about tennis specifically, which comes out early next year. And so F1 kind of wrote this playbook for streaming media in sports content.
I really like the pickup, Albert, and I was thinking of putting the F1 sort of group in my top companies to go over. And to me, it was because it was emblematic of that move towards content through a sporting lens and the amount of money that's washing through sport at the moment. So anyone is familiar with some of the major sports happening at the moment. Manchester United, their owners have suggested that they're open to a sale, valuing the company, when I say company, but valuing the sporting club at about $7 billion. The Phoenix Suns, an NBA basketball team in America, has got a similar kind of price tag attached to it. 10 years, 15, 20 years ago, these companies were being sold for, you know, the hundreds of millions, but definitely not the billions of dollars. And now they're absolutely smashing through that ceiling. So there's just so much money in these sports. And I think if I'm trying to, you know, reverse engineer why these franchises, these businesses, these interests are becoming so popular and monetized, Albert, it's, I think, this idea, and you kind of hit on it, that Formula One had a much smaller fan base before Netflix, but they definitely had an avid fan base. Like, they had an almost frenetic, you know, absolutely, you know, community driven. They would get up, watch it every time, late at night. And I think that is kind of the play as companies are looking for content, is they're looking for almost like a very well proven source of content. And that might be sports, that might be, you know, you look at some of the fantasy books, novel series, which are then getting turned into movies and TV series. Really, I feel like a lot of content aggregators, producers, they're trying to find the next big hit. And the way they're doing it is they're looking for proven content in a much smaller fan base. And then they're trying to just push it to all the masses. And I think that's what they did with F1. You know, they found a really rabid fan base, which was niche and small. And then they just said, well, let's turbocharge it, thanks for the pun, and just really mainstream it. And they just took the plunge that if a smaller subset of people would love the content, then once it was produced to a mass audience, that would also gain the traction it needed. So the thing that made me continue to think about that podcast, Albert, is seeing it pop up in different fields, not just sport, but also content as well.
Yeah. What underpins what you're saying is two really key things. The first is the ability to generate that content at scale, which for anyone who understands or watches sport, like, that's just a given. Like, in NBA, there's 82 games plus the playoffs. Then you've got all these personalities. Each of these people are generating content at scale because you've got this many games. In Formula One, you know, you've got these races, you've got all the leads up to races and things like that. And so because of that, you can generate content at scale easily without having to get, you know, writers and producers and people in a room together. And the second is you've got a diverse set of characters who appeal to the wide audience. So when you talk about scaling it and pumping it out to like a broader audience base, because you've got drivers from all these different countries and all these different backgrounds, it's very easy for that to scale across a broad set of audiences, because suddenly you've got people who've got, you know, different cultural backgrounds or come from different countries, they can easily cling on to a particular driver. Like, you know, there's really, really popular drivers in Australia, but there's no real Australian drivers. You know, there's people who like look at German drivers or Swedish drivers or Japanese drivers or whatever, in a completely different way to people like rooting for the Socceroos in the World Cup, because that's our default team.
Mark Webber fans and Daniel Ricciardo fans are coming for you, Albert. There are a couple of Australians.
I'm going to blame it all on, you know, I'm going to say jet lag is the reason why I completely forgot about Daniel Ricciardo, the Australian GOAT. Sorry.
though he is without a team, or at least he's the third driver for Red Bull now, so he's not going to be on the main stage for next year. That being said, Albert, do you want to pivot to the next one? You got anything else to add on Formula One?
No, let's do it, Dan. Who's first off your list?
The one I wanted to get into first, Albert, is it's actually a twofer, so I'm cheating a little bit. But when we started this year, and it was really interesting for me just going through our list of episodes and seeing like how our tastes kind of changed or developed, and we kind of got into certain niches where for a whole month, you know, we'd be doing some tech, and then the next month we'd be doing a completely different field. And what was interesting to me was at the start of the year, we did have a lot of tech companies. We had a lot of software, we had a lot of social media. And then at some point, we made this sort of switch to hardware where we were doing Samsung, we were doing Sony, DJI, Razer. And so those last two, which I'm wanting to sort of hit on, DJI, our 99th episode, Razer, our 103rd. And to me, it was, I hadn't really thought of what you could call the Apple playbook, because I think before we did those episodes, particularly DJI, I thought of Apple as being kind of like a one of one, a unicorn that, you know, you had Steve Jobs, super charismatic founder, CEO, and they just sort of built the company around that. And I thought that can't really be replicated. There can't be another Apple. And particularly when we looked at DJI, you know, and we both, I think, came to that same conclusion, I think you prompted it, was like, this is a very Apple-like business. You know, in the drone world, no other company has as much market share as them. They sell, you know, about 95% of the unmanned aerial vehicles, priced between $350 and $2,000. They are by far the premium go-to product. No other company comes close in terms of the hardware and software interaction, just something you can think of Apple with, not only its hardware, but its iOS that sits behind it as well. And so to me, it was just like, there are more than one Apple out there, and perhaps they're not as recognized or acknowledged as Apple, and therein lies an opportunity. That's been something I've been thinking about since those episodes.
Nice. What do you think makes it a barrier for companies to become more like Apple? Like, why is it that a company like DJI can start up and be like Apple-esque, or like Xiaomi, which is another company that we talked about, which has like Apple-esque products?
I think it's actually, I don't know if it's a choice so much as it's like a badge that you earn, where like what sets DJI apart is kind of simple, but also very hard to achieve. And that is that the product they produce is nth degrees better than their competitors. And if you ask any company, you know, how you can be successful, that would be an answer to the question. But actually being able to execute and achieve it, that's where the badge of honor comes in. It's like, not every company can attract the right talent, develop the right culture, have the right innovation within, have the right, you know, just everything just sort of line up well. To me, it's not luck. There must be some sort of framework which they're working towards. And that to me is why it's sort of, it's the holy grail of running a business. It's not something that you can necessarily replicate by design. And I'm sure there's lots of MBAs, et cetera, that will go into case studies trying to replicate it. But it is just quite simply like, they are better than their competitors. They're better than everyone else. And they can seem to sustain that over the long run. Apple, I think, has obviously done it for a much longer period than DJI. But that then is their new challenge, is just sustaining their excellence.
Yeah, I wonder, part of me thinks is like, is it a first mover advantage with DJI? Because they were one of the very first consumer drone companies, and they created this category, right? In the same way that Apple created their smartphone category. And because they were category makers, they could dictate the look and feel of a product, as opposed to coming in as like the second or third or nth competitor and having to differentiate on like price or differentiate on quality. Because when you are the category maker, you set the standard for what it is. I'm not saying that by default that they could, but because DJI was one of the first people in or first companies in consumer drones, they got to really dictate how they played in the category, whereas other people have to kind of follow and choose counter strategies in order to win.
I think that's really insightful, because when I'm trying to think of like who are the other Apple businesses out there in the world, one that comes to mind is Tesla. And I think that plays into what you're saying, Albert, where they are, you know, they made the category of premium electronic cars. They can really set the market there. They've earned the reputation. And now they're really starting to drive up their revenue as they just scale and scale up. And so I think that is right. But then, you know, you got to think of some of the other companies out there as, you know, to a certain extent, I don't know if Apple really did pioneer the first smartphone. I think there were iterations beforehand from some of the other competitors that were out there. They just kind of made it their own. They really went hard and did it well compared to their competitors. You know, I think the obvious example being Steve Jobs talking about the stylus. Why use a stylus when you can use your finger? In that sense, there were smartphones before the iPhone, but no one quite committed to it and really owned the category until Apple sort of arrived on the scene. So I think there is something in that.
Yeah, I think the other thing is like the evolution of how you become a premium brand. And maybe we're getting off topic here, but like Dyson is a good example of this, which is like, if I look at like general household goods, Dyson is like the Apple of that, where they've got, you know, their incredible vacuum cleaners and things like that. But they weren't the first mover in the space. So it is like possible to become like Apple-esque with a brand and pricing power in the same way that like DJI has.
Let's stay on this, Albert, because I might go into my second one, because it just fits onto what we're talking about. LVMH, Louis Vuitton Moët Hennessy, our 92nd episode breakdown. That is exactly what you're talking about, is like in almost a different frame, where they are leveraging their very, very, very old brands that they have in their house. You know, Louis Vuitton, Fendi, Givenchy, Sephora, all of these other sort of brands. They're really leveraging, I guess, heritage and prestige to formulate their branding, which is somewhat different to a DJI and Apple, etc., who obviously in a different industry in tech, they're trying to like come up and establish their brand, whereas Louis Vuitton is almost really trying to maintain and foster its brand that they've had for, you know, a long, long time.
Yeah, I think Louis Vuitton's also another interesting case, because not only are they a premium brand, so LVMH, I should use their entire name, but not only are they a premium brand, they also acquire brands who are probably at different levels of premium to them, to then bring them up to that status. It's almost like a status acquisition. Oh, instead of diluting the brand by acquiring it, you're actually uplifting that brand. And the other thing is like they also launch brands, and because they've launched brands from a high status, those brands are also high status. They're like a high status powerhouse.
Yeah, exactly. So in 2019, they acquired Tiffany for $16 billion. You know, that's a classic example of a brand which we all know. Like everyone knows Breakfast at Tiffany's, Tiffany necklace, Tiffany diamonds, all those sorts of things. But it's really like in the last couple of years, after they've folded into Louis Vuitton, Moët Hennessy, what do they call it? House of Brands, that, you know, now they've got Jay-Z, Beyonce, they've got all these influencers from that house of brands that are now not giving it a facelift, but you think of some of like the older generations that are associated with Tiffany, now they're being brought into the 21st century. Modern, young, rich, wealthy people want to wear that brand, and that makes a big difference.
Yeah, I think while we're talking about brand, it's worth to like call out like how to identify what is actually a good brand versus not a good brand. And there's obviously lots of different ways, because you can see it based on premium, but talking about financials is like, is gross margin. Like if a brand has strong gross margin relative to its peers, it means it has brand power. Because if it has high gross margin, it means it can price higher relative to its brands and people are buying it at that price. And because people are buying at that price, it means it's got a strong brand. So that's a good way to understand like relative power and branding against companies in the same category.
Yeah, and a great example of that is Bulgari, which LVMH acquired. Once they acquired, you know, several years afterwards, sales doubled and profit, this is going to that margin point you're talking about, Albert, profit rose fivefold. So that goes to tell you the effect that that house of brands had on what you'd expect to already be a good premium solid brand like Bulgari, but just ratcheting it up to the next level. And so this has got me thinking about brands in a whole different way once we did that episode.
Yeah, and I think, you know, it's worth like saying before we move on that like brand is not just like the colors and the logo. Like branding is everything a company does to establish its eminence. So like with LMVH, it's like the products it builds, where it plays in, the fact that it doesn't discount, the fact that it's got these like celebrities and things like that endorsing the product, the fact that they price in a particular way, the fact that they sell only a select amount of products. Like everything they do reinforces the brand, but the brand is more than just, you know, like the colors and the logo. It's everything that this business does to build eminence.
Okay, Albert, what's your second company you wanted to go into?
Look, I think while we talk about brand, I'm going to talk about the New York Times. This is a company mm-hmm. that I learned a lot about looking at this business. I think New York Times is a really interesting business across all the companies that we look at, because they are an incumbent business that has transformed completely and is still winning against other competitors. And it's pretty rare that we've talked about incumbent businesses on this podcast. And then pretty rare that we've talked about incumbent businesses that are still winning.
100%. And I was thinking, and you've pipped me, this is my third company that I was going to look at, New York Times, Albert, episode 87 for us. Because of that fact that you just mentioned there, that they reputation is one thing, but constantly innovating with purpose is something that New York Times did very, very successfully. So, you know, it now has its largest source of growth being its digital subscription service, which has over 10 million paid users. That was used to pivot away from advertising, which now just accounts for about 45% of their revenue, when about 15 years ago, advertising was 80% of their revenue. And you can't really think of any other print business which has done that transition as successfully as the New York Times. And in their field, you have to say, like, they've essentially created a playbook for any other print business. The only surprising thing is, like, it just seems like other print businesses aren't doing what they're doing. And that begs the question, maybe it goes to an execution point that they want to, but they just can't. And that, again, highlights how good the New York Times is.
Yeah, good, great call out, Dan. I think the other thing while we talk about brand is like the New York Times is one of the most influential businesses in the world because it is news. And because it's news, it can write something with a particular slant and people will read that and accept that for what it is, which may be opinion, it may be an op-ed, it may be like a slightly biased news article. But you can't deny that this is, you know, one of the highest quality news outlets, which shapes and influences how people, not just in the US, but people globally in the Western world think. So I think that is super interesting when it comes to brand. It's like people trust this brand so much that they will think what the New York Times writes.
Well, I'm going to push back there a little bit because I agree that's the core. But when I think about what made their growth successful, particularly their switch to digital subscriptions, it's actually that they bolstered the core with things unrelated. Like when we looked at what really made them jump in terms of their numbers, it's the fact that they've got, you know, 1 million plus games and cooking subscriptions, the fact that they acquired Wordle, the fact that they've got, you know, 181 million listeners on their New York Times podcast, you know, going to different mediums. Like it's these sorts of things which I think really bolstered the core. Like as you said, if it comes to news, actual reporting, particularly during the Trump years, they had this eminence which people took to be true. But did that help them grow, or was that just the core? And what really helped them grow was the fact that they added on tangents, you know, people who want to be doing the New York Times crossword, cooking subscriptions, recipes, those sorts of things. To me, it was a very brave move to say, you know, we are a serious, eminent publisher of the news, but we're also going to tell you how to cook your, you know, Thanksgiving turkey, like, and really lean into that. And that's what I think sets them apart, is that they've got a brand and a reputation, but they're not just that. They're a lot more as well.
Yeah, I mean, they kind of go hand in hand, right? Like, if you discount or if you not think about news, like, hey, I need to cook my turkey. Am I going to go to the New York Times? Am I going to go to taste.com? Like, I trust the New York Times.
Yes,
so I'm going to use their recipe. So what underpins that is the trust that people give the New York Times. And because people trust them, it has earned them the right to do things like recipes and, you know, like other forms of content, like Wirecutter, which does reviews of products, you know, because they've built this complete trust that people have with them, it lets them do all these other things. So it's the reputation and the brand, which is underpinned by trust that the New York Times has because it's known for its high quality journalism, that then lets them do all these things that you've mentioned.
While we're on the New York Times, Albert, I was thinking about this as I was running through our episode. So forgive the tangent before we get to your third and final company to deep dive into. But I was thinking about Meta, you know, Facebook, particularly given the recent news. You know, they had a huge drop in their share price following, I think, their third quarter earnings report. Generally behind, you know, Meta's shift towards the metaverse, plowing billions of dollars into R&D for metaverse, etc., which is just cutting into their profits. To me, it's a really interesting analogy to look at Meta, or let's just talk Facebook for the moment. Facebook's brand eminence in social media, but how they really didn't, I think, foster that brand or maintain that brand. And now I think there's a real trust deficit in terms of what they're trying to do next. And it's just interesting for me to compare how the New York Times has sort of kept its brand, kept its premium offering and pivoted, while Facebook has not kept its brand and is now trying to pivot. And I think that lack of trust is really affecting the confidence that investors have in them being able to make that leap.
Yeah, it's hard to understand where Facebook went wrong in terms of branding and trust, and whether it's like how Facebook chooses to show people, you know, information or ads, or how it curates things, or, you know, the role it played in election manipulation, you know, all these different things. The fact that it's never got, you know, a positive news article, something we talked about when you talked about Meta or Facebook as a whole. So I think it's really hard, but the core I think that cuts through this is like user-generated content versus curated, edited content. And so for Facebook, because it's user-generated content, you know, content comes in all forms, which is it can be really high-quality posts, and there are like high-quality gated communities on Facebook and Facebook groups and things like that. But there's also a lot of really low-quality and low value content on Facebook. And that's like, you know, posts that people talk about like misinformation or sharing fake news or really terrible opinions about things or racism or anti-Semitism and things like that. Versus the New York Times, which is like edited and curated content. And it's written in such a way that is like, you know, generally data driven. It's got editors, it's got people who quality control. And I think because you've got this spectrum where they kind of sit on opposite ends, it's easier to trust the New York Times because there's like a process of governance where Facebook posts don't have that.
Albert, are we going to hit your last one now?
Yeah, so the last one is a company that I actually ended up investing in after, and we discussed it. And again, this is really just a podcast about entertainment, so don't take this as financial advice, but it's a business called Snowflake, which is a data business. You know, for anyone who's not familiar with Snowflake, definitely listen to our episode on it. It's episode 86, because it's a pretty technical business. But you know, for, you know, quick rundown as a teaser to the episode, like they're like a platform business that offers data platform as a cloud service. They enable a lot of different things, including data storage, data processing, and analytics. But the reason why actually I love this business, because it is like incredibly high growth, really strong performing business that has created this like really good playbook and a playbook that not many other companies can follow, where it onboards customers at either like, you know, a discount to get them in. And then across the years of retention, it manages to get these customers to pay more for data and pay more for data storage, and then increasing its revenue growth. So really, really strong revenue growth. But over the past year, they've had like 150% plus net revenue retention rate, which means for every customer who was giving them a dollar in the previous year, they are now giving them $1.50 this year. So you can see how they're squeezing more revenue out of their existing customers. And I think that's a really, really good proof point as to the fact that people love this business.
Yeah, as again, I mentioned that earlier on, I was flicking through our episodes and I saw a bunch of themes cropping up. What was interesting to me, Albert, was last year, you know, first year of the pod, we actually did hit on a lot of, you know, cloud data sharing with Microsoft, with Amazon, and I think Cloudflare was last year as well, yeah, episode 45. And then we kind of had a bit of a hiatus from our love of data sharing and cloud infrastructure, etc. And then along comes Snowflake this year. I'm sort of interested in your take. You know, where do you think cloud is at the moment? Do you think it's now, you know, last year maybe it was a little bit more top of mind, a little bit more newsworthy, the sexy kind of investing topic, and now it's starting to become a bit like infrastructure, which is very important, very necessary, but, you know, less interesting to talk about? Or where do you think it is currently, like that sort of space?
Yeah, it's a good question. So, you know, I think it's probably like obviously not in the news because we're in a bit of downturn, so these companies tend to be less quiet. But I think there's like a maturity in public markets where people are more comfortable with cloud businesses. And so because you've got this like cohort of like on-prem companies have now shifted to cloud, so like Adobe, Microsoft, Oracle, et cetera, you've got like the next wave of cloud businesses that have come in, you know, Xero, Cloudflare, you know, all these great cloud companies, Workday, et cetera. And now you've got these like probably more technical cloud businesses who are going public, like Snowflake, Databricks, Datadog, things like that. So I think there is a maturity in understanding how cloud businesses works across investors generally, which means people are more likely to like invest to understand how these businesses work. I think specifically for Snowflake, there's like a core thesis that I really love, which is like, there's more data than ever, right? In this world, there is absolutely more data than ever. And that data needs to live somewhere because it can't just live on people's hard drives or servers and things like that. And then you got to analyze that data. And so there's like three key things Snowflake solves for those things. And if you really believe in those three key things, it's kind of a no-brainer why you think Snowflake is going to be a really important company moving forward.
Albert, I didn't mention to you this before we started recording the pod, but I'm going to do it to you now and just throw it to you. Is if you're going to Spotify Wrapped our 2022 with a bit of a theme of what we've sort of learned from the companies we've looked at, what would it be? And I'll give you a little bit of time because my word, which would pop up, you know, in big sort of fluoro lights as Spotify Wrapped does, would be curation. And I think that hits on the point we're just talking about there. Snowflake's thesis in a world of lots of data, curation, ability to access it is going to be key. New York Times, curation of content, LVMH, curation of products, design, good fashion. Like I think in a world where like it's just more, curation is to me going to be such a powerful driver of a successful business. What about you?
Yeah, curation, that's a really, really good point, Dan. I absolutely agree with that. Curation is so incredibly important in a world where there's just like so much noise out there and you want someone to distinguish and do the work for you. I think the other kind of big one for me that comes up that's kind of pervasive across a lot of the companies that we've looked at this year, I'm going to say community. And I know that's kind of like a buzzword in tech at the moment. So maybe community isn't the right word. But I think about how across a lot of companies that we've looked at this year, how they've managed to really connect with and then monetize their customers, fans, get them to do like fan-to-fan engagement, get them to build communities around them. So I think that that's a really big one. Like Snowflake, it's like getting the developer community together, you know, for something like FONA or Formula One, obviously like the F1 community. You've got like in-person events and things like that. You know, there's so many different ways we can cut community across the companies, you know, we've looked at. You know, even like Samsung and Toei and all these other companies and gaming and anime, like there's communities around them. We did Bilibili that has like a community gated service and things like that. So community is a big one.
Nice. And that's a good call out to our Fresh Cap community. I've definitely had a couple of people mention to me in the last couple of weeks. They've been listening to episodes. They particularly liked our fiery exchange in the last episode on Bilibili. So, you know, really appreciate the feedback and more just generally the conversations we've been having, Albert, I guess, with listeners, particularly with Spotify Wrapped coming up and people are letting us know that they've been listening to the pod and posting on their socials about the pod. You're right. It makes what you do very satisfying. It also, I think, lends some sort of importance and weight to what you're doing because it's not like we're just yelling into a microphone at each other. There is a broader community that's participating in this conversation, which is really lively.
No, for sure. Thank you to everyone. I know I posted on my Instagram the other day and Dan shared it with me that we were like top 5 most shared globally. So I really do appreciate everyone who does listen to this.
Yeah, listen and share and everything else. So we're about to wrap. I know next Sunday is going to be Christmas. Albert and I discussed we probably will have an episode that will drop on Christmas Day. So once you're full from Christmas breakfast, lunch, dinner, whatever, pop it on, give us a listen. And if you've got any ideas for episodes you want to hear in the new year, let us know. You know, I mean, we always get emails coming in from listeners with ideas and things. So don't be shy. Let us know. And thank you again for another year of listening with Fresh Cap. Thanks again, and we'll see you next week. See ya.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Fresh Capital. Every week, we provide a refreshingly simple way to learn how companies operate and how investing works. Just a reminder, all information contained in this podcast is for education and entertainment purposes only. It is not intended as a substitute for professional, financial, legal, or tax advice. The hosts of Fresh Capital are not financial professionals and are not aware of your personal financial circumstances. Any opinions expressed in the show are not recommendations or advice. Please consult a licensed financial professional before you jump in. As always, we look forward to seeing you next week. See ya.